My theme today is the commercial aspects of space. After all, that's what the Australian Space Industry Chamber of Commerce exists to promote. And the significant thing about the history of space, and we're talking about something like 45, 50 years since the launch of the first artificial satellite, that over that period there has been two main sources of activity and funding. Originally it was government, and back in 1973 government internationally paid for 80% of all activity, but by 1998 it was 50-50. And so the commercial side of space is just as important as the government side. It represents a major paradigm shift in the drivers of space business, and it has important implications for this country. One way of looking at the history of space development, and I should give credit here to my colleague Bill Barrett from APSC, who developed these slides and did a lot of work on this presentation. So if some of you may find these ideas familiar if you've heard Bill speak. But the three phases that we think we can identify are, first of all, the exploration phase of space, then the experimentation phase, and we now believe that we're into the exploitation phase. Now, there's no clear distinction in time between these phases, and sometimes and often these activities overlap, but we think we can identify differences between the early stages of space development and the phases we're in now. And parallels can be drawn between the development of space and earlier periods in history, such as the opening of the New World, the development of the aviation industry, radio, undersea exploration, etc. The exploration phase was characterised by the journey into the unknown, the high cost and the high risk of all activities. It was driven, as you are well aware, by government agendas, and in particular the contest between the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And as a result, everything was funded by governments. You will recall that the Apollo program in the US was supported very strongly by not only by the president, President Kennedy, who conceived the program, but by Congress. And I'm told that during that decade, there was virtually no limit on the availability of funds for the purpose of achieving the goal of getting to the moon first. That idea, and I'm sure Brian will agree, is totally foreign to contemporary space professionals and people dealing with governments these days. And it's the same in the US, not just in this country. So the features of the exploration phase was that it was subject to the vagaries of political and bureaucratic processes, and it was driven by what government wants at the pace that they dictated and by their rules. The next phase, the experimentation phase, was initiated by the successes and the obvious applications identified in the exploration phase. It involved high cost but lower risk, because many of these missions had already proved certain technologies. It focused on understanding the new environment and developing the means of operating. It was driven by issues of government prestige, as well as military and economic agendas, as other governments, not just the two leading powers in the world, became involved and interested and set up their own programs. But again, it was funded almost exclusively by governments. And so it had the same features. It was what government wants at government pace and by government rules. But slowly industry became aware of opportunities, but it expected government to take the lead, and perhaps the European Space Agency and the system they developed for allocating contracts to companies based in Europe is a very good example of that model. The last phase that we like to identify, the exploitation phase, was characterised by technology and science in a new medium that was well understood. It's characterised by demonstrating the value of operating in the new medium. It means that unique services are possible. Brian mentioned the ability to deliver broadband services anywhere on the continent of Australia using satellite technology. That's a good example. The costs remain high, but commercial returns can be demonstrated, and industry leverages off government infrastructure or builds its own. And I would put particular emphasis on the fact that the infrastructure, the existence of the infrastructure provided by public funds, can be critical in making a commercial case for a particular application. So the difference is that the industry takes the lead and invests, sometimes with government help and support of various kinds, and sometimes it does it all on its own. And of course, market forces, the potential for economic return by the investors, determines whether or not private investment can be attracted. So when you think about it diagrammatically, you can see that the role of industry and the importance of industry has changed and over time. And when you think about the activities of regulation, funding pure research, science research, those roles are still, of course, with the government. But things like setting the actual agenda for missions and programs, developing infrastructure, financing projects, operating systems, producing products and developing markets and building the hardware, these roles are shifting. So just to elaborate on the phases in the development of space, it's not always easy to see these changes from where we sit, because most of us are, well, certainly in my case, I'm only really conscious of the factors and pressures and dynamics of space activities in the last 5 or 10 years. But it is a global industry, and it's important to understand what's happening in Australia fits in globally. And a good example of the differences are in the three main United Nations convened space conferences that we've had, Unispace 1, 2 and 3. The first was in 68, the second was in 82, and the third was in 99. The 68 conference was all about space development, exploration. It was very much a government-oriented conference. It had input into the development of the UN space treaties, which you will probably know are only about regulating the obligations of governments and the relations between governments in relation to space activities. And we're stuck with those treaties. It's almost impossible to persuade the community of countries that have signed those treaties that they need revision and overhaul and rethinking. So that very much set the framework for international space law. The second phase in 82 was more about the programs and what could be done using space technology and the development of space applications. They were talking about the first platforms for humans working in space, but again, it was government programs. There was more cooperation emerging, between countries, and the European Space Agency was then well established. The one area in which there was private investment emerging was in telecommunications satellites, and as you well know, that is the sector of space activity that has now become almost an entirely a commercially funded and privately owned activity internationally. And then the third Unispace conference, which some of us were fortunate enough to be present at, was a totally different conference, because the private sector, the global commercial space industry, was very prominent. Sometimes as the delegates were invited by their governments to be part of the delegation, and the Australian government did that. But there were also industry exhibitions and briefings, and it was very much seen as a partnership between the governments, who after all are the members of the United Nations, and the global private sector in space. So what are the implications of this background for Australia? Well, clearly that analysis shows the trend to the commercial exploitation of space. In a world where space activities are determined by government spending, we know the history of this country is that the government has always seen itself as playing a minor role. However, we believe that a shift to a commercial paradigm can make Australia a more significant player in the international space community. If you think about what are the requirements for a national space industry where governments drive the programs, and if I could just comment upon our role in this region, if we regard ourselves as part of the Asian region, when you visit the other countries in this region of comparable size to us, as well as the larger countries, this is the paradigm under which they operate. Countries of comparable size to Australia in terms of technology, if not population, would be Korea, Taiwan, Malaysia and Thailand. All of these countries have significant space applications programs in which their governments pour in financial support and infrastructure far greater than our Australian government has ever done. So this is the sort of paradigm under which those programs operate. The areas in which the government intervention is high, where there's a political will to fund an industry, where there may be manufacturing skills to turn technology into space products, and where there may be an underlying infrastructure, such as government purchase of launch technology or government provision of launch infrastructure, certainly in the case of Japan and China. However, the paradigm is turned on its head if you're talking about a commercially driven national program. The sort of things in which we feature highly in this country are that we have a stable political environment which encourages investment, a robust commercial system where goods and services are freely traded, a legal framework to protect assets and regulate safety, and I can tell you a lot about that, but that's not the topic of my talk today, a market for the goods and services produced in space, and well-developed service industries to support space, such as finance, insurance, legal expertise, environmental assessment, consulting, PR and marketing, and also a technology base and a fundamental know-how of space, including the considerable expertise and research capability we have in our universities in this country. Where we feature low in this country is in the manufacturing schools to turn technology into space products, although, as you've heard from Brian today, by necessity we were required to virtually to manufacture our own satellite in this country at short notice. And the underlying infrastructure, such as a national launch vehicle and launch sites, and by launch sites I mean more than just the land or the ranges, but the actual infrastructure for to carry on launches. So we argue that our position improves in a commercial space world. It inverts the paradigm. Our strengths are in our political and economic systems, and our attitude to free trade, both within the country and externally, and our lack of dependence upon government support as either customers or simply as funders for programs. So I've listed there, and I admit that it may not be a totally accurate list, and it may be a little out of date. And for example, we heard today that Ares is no longer an existing program, but there are activities, Australian-based, Australian-sponsored launch projects, a diminishing number, I have to say, and that's disappointment to those of us who have been working on launch projects for some time. Australian-initiated satellite constellations, not always based now in Australia and certainly raising funding from overseas sources. A growing number of telemetry and tracking operations. Local satellite programs, including, of course, FedSat, which I believe will give a huge boost to the profile of the industry in a couple of weeks' time, and we must think of how we can capitalise on that that publicity and the success of that program, and the growing interest in re-entry missions in Australia, that is, using our ranges for the purpose of allowing the re-entry of foreign-launched missions. So, industry information is very important, and that's where I think the Space Industry Chamber of Commerce plays a role. We facilitate communication between all of the players involved in commercial space. We were founded in 1992, as a national organisation with chapters in most of the major cities. Our charter is to create a forum for the interchange of ideas about projects and ventures, to provide a point of contact for organisations seeking information, to provide an industry view on matters affecting space activities, and to foster public awareness of the space industry in general. We, I believe, are well regarded as an industry voice for space in Australia. Our members come from a broad range of activities, some more hands-on and some hands-off and very much in the background, such as people like me with legal expertise. But you do need all of these various disciplines in order to make a successful space program. We've had an active role, probably a leading role, in the industry input into the development of our regulatory system for space launches in Australia and for overseas, Australian space missions launched from overseas. I was very interested to hear Brian's comment about the cost that the regulatory system has added. Part of it is the International Telecommunications Frequency Allocation System, which has always existed. It's been around for 100 years, and that's not new, but it is a cost and a complication, and it is all done through the Australian government as a member of the International Telecommunications Union, organising the allocation of appropriate frequencies for space missions. However, the Space Activities Act was introduced in 1998 by the federal government as a means of promoting and facilitating an Australian space launch industry. It was, the catalyst was Kistler. Kistler came to Australia with very big plans and with a great vision, and they certainly captured the imagination of the federal government. And the federal government was very willing to facilitate a domestic regulation system, which was seen as important, especially for overseas launch providers. Over the next 3 years, the reality of regulating space activities became more and more a question of safety and of addressing the concerns of other industries, in particular the petroleum exploration industry, who were concerned that their facilities and infrastructure would be hit by out-of-control rockets and would cause great damage to infrastructure, admittedly important infrastructure, including gas pipelines and things like that. So the whole atmosphere of the government debate, the government rhetoric over space has changed over a period of 3 or 4 years, from facilitating a launch industry to regulating a launch industry, ensuring public safety and imposing standards equivalent to the standards expected of the commercial aviation industry, but on an industry in which the technology in many cases has yet to be proved. And so I asked myself what would have happened if the government had regulated commercial aviation at its inception in the same way as it is attempting to regulate the commercial space launch industry. So it is a major, it is, has become a major burden for, especially for new space launch projects, and even for organisations wishing to launch their satellites overseas. Other issues we've been involved in is sales tax exemption, GST exemption on the importation of space hardware, ITAR restrictions, the restrictions on dual-use technology that the United States in particular imposes, and interesting questions about the Moon Treaty that I don't have time to go into. We're regularly requested to provide industry input to the government. We're seen as the, as I said, the main voice for the industry on policy issues. And we've had input into the recent government inquiry, if you like, or a group which has been convened to attempt to advise the government on where it should be going in terms of its own policy, as well as setting a blueprint for the industry in the future. So we talk of a renaissance. Sitting here this year, looking at the way some projects have come and gone, one is not always able to feel as optimistic as the word renaissance would imply, but optimism is a very important thing for people involved in space. The projects are extremely long, complicated, suffer setbacks, and one has to remain committed and optimistic. So that's our message. We believe that there is a commercial paradigm that gives Australia a role in space. We think that commercialisation lowers many of the previous barriers to participation. We have many of the innate capabilities, talent, knowledge and skills that are required. We've been able to demonstrate that private funding can be found for well-conceived projects. admittedly at high risk to the investors. It's up to individuals like us and the private sector to make it happen. So I finish with a message of promise and renaissance for Australian space. Thank you.